nothing in the world that I like better than bacon and lettuce and homegrown tomatoes. Up in the morning, out in the garden, get you ripe when you don't get a hard one. Plant them in the spring, eat them in the summer. All winter without them's a culinary bummer. I forget all about the sweating and digging every time I go out and pick me a pig. Homegrown tomatoes, homegrown tomatoes. What'll I be without homegrown tomatoes? Only two things that money can't buy, and that's true love and homegrown tomatoes.
Hello out there, my friends. In the Garden with Ed Byarski and myself is brought to you in part by The Flower Farm, now featuring season-end opportunities on all outdoor plants. Lots of perennials, trees, and shrubs. Plant this fall for a gorgeous summer next year. They're open 10 to 5 every day except Wednesdays at 10 Rory Road, Papke's Landing.
Put them on the side, put them in the middle, put a homegrown tomato on a hot cake griddle. Homegrown tomatoes, homegrown tomatoes. What'll I be without homegrown tomatoes? Only two things that money can't buy, and that's true love and homegrown tomatoes.
Hey there, Ed. Have we got you on the phone?
I'm here.
All right. Well, it's a pleasure to speak to you again there, my friend.
It's a good day. Got another project done and in the books, so we're heading home. I'm going to, probably among other things, I'm going to pick some more tomatoes, ripe tomatoes, and make some more fresh salsa. So ooh. I'm hoping folks in Petersburg are doing that, can certainly do that. A friend of mine has got some hot peppers she's going to give me in exchange for some tomatoes, and I've got my own shallots and onions and cilantro to go with it, so it should be some good stuff. The batch we made a few days ago turned out really well. Fresh salsa can't be beat.
No, nothing beats fresh salsa, and those sound like the perfect ingredients.
Yeah, and of course it's easy to freeze. You know, you just have plastic containers or jars to that you can freeze some for the winter time. So get good flavor. The tomatoes are looking good. And something I mentioned to you earlier is a reminder to folks. It came to me, of course, while this weekend I was picking kiwis to make a kiwi pie, and they are ripening very fast. Certainly in Peter, I assume there's some folks down in Petersburg. I've sent some plants down there, certainly.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem with them is that they fall faster than raspberries do when they're ripe. So if you're up picking your berries, it's almost worthwhile putting down a tarp or sheet or something like that underneath if you have open ground underneath them. Because if you bump the vine, the ripe one may fall off another part of the vine.
Wow.
When they're still green, they hold on pretty tightly. They're rather tight, and they're hard. When you feel them, and that's how I check to see if they're ripe. But once they can ripen fairly quickly, and they start to get soft, and that's when you need to pick them for fresh eating, for making pies. And some folks do make jams and jellies with them. They've got kind of a funny color to them, but certainly they are very tasty.
Mm.
So definitely need to harvest those.
Right. Okay. So now's the time. Gosh, I bet
pick the first ones again this year, kind of like other stuff. They were starting to ripen early. I picked the first few last week of August, and it's just like everything else. It's getting earlier. When I first started, we put some of these in the early 90s. And the first years, it was mid to late September when they were ripening. So that has moved up 2 to 3 weeks over the course of about 20 years.
Wow. Yeah, gosh. It feels like it's going faster and faster as far as that.
Yeah, it does.
Calendar,
it does. I mean, last week I was trying to say, oh, let's not call it fall yet. Well, it feels like fall now. You know, we had that incredible, beautiful weather And now, and leaves are turning color. Leaves are changing fast and falling. And the weather, we're back to our more normal rainy fall weather, and there's some really heavy rains predicted, remnants of the hurricane that came past Hawaii.
Well, yeah, and winds, too. I mean, there's going to be some bare trees and kiwis where there's not a piece of fruit left on it, I'm sure, by Saturday.
Right, exactly.
We're going to get
so it's
battered.
Time also, then, to think about bulb planting. And, again, I'm not sure if you're seeing them in your stores, but they are here in Juneau already. Some of them are.
Mm-hmm.
So folks need to start thinking about where, if they plant some bulbs, or if they want to plant, add some if they remember what they had last spring, and hopefully maybe they might have marked areas where they would like to plant some bulbs, and do some soil improvement. Again, for most bulbs that we want to plant, they come from the Middle East, and high elevations, which is, and dry summer areas. And of course, we don't have that.
Right.
But we really do need to try to improve the drainage in the areas where we're going to plant these. They do not like being planted in low spots in swampy areas. So drainage is most important for any kind of bulbs we're going to be planting. And, of course, you have more than I do, although there's some local spots, selected spots in Juneau, where the deer are definitely an issue. So if you have deer wandering through your gardens, then you may want to not plant tulips. Tulips are a deer favorite, and it seems like about 15 minutes before those big tulip flower buds open, the deer are there munching them off.
Right.
So if you can't fence them out of your yard, then choose some deer-resistant bulbs. Hmm. Daffodils are really good. Lucilla, snowdrops. Crocus can go either way. I've certainly had deer eat my crocus.
Hmm.
And lilies, too, if you have access to lilies. That's something the deer definitely like, lilies.
Oh.
So you want to be careful about what you're going to be planting for your own enjoyment.
Right. Hmm. Well, gosh, that is an important thing to consider around here for sure. The deer,
you know, and normally we, if you're going to this store, they will have, whether they have packaged bulbs, sometimes they'll just have loose bulbs in a box, but usually there are also cultural tips on small piece of paper, and read that stuff. It tells on those, usually on the packages and stuff, how deep you want to plant them, how far apart to space them. And worth also considering is that you can layer bulbs in a hole so that you have a longer period of blooming.
Wow.
Sometimes stretching out over 3 to 4 weeks rather than just 1 week, where usually tulips, a specific variety of tulip or daffodil, and again, this depends on the weather. If we have cooler, moist weather, then that will stretch out an individual flower's lasting period. But if we've got warm, sunny weather in the spring when they're blooming, sometimes it's 3 days, the flower pops open, and they're done. So that's something to also think about. So if we have different varieties, you look again on the packages, it may say early, mid, and late season, like for tulips or daffodils and some others. So we can plan for a longer season of bloom.
And when you say layer,
and we could do this all in the same hole. Mm. I normally dig trenches. Mm-hmm. I dig a trench that's usually about 8 inches deep. That's for the big bulbs, tulips, daffodils, and lilies.
Mm-hmm.
Scratch my fertilizer down in the bottom of that trench, and the trench may be a foot wide, it may be 2 feet long. That soil goes over into a wheelbarrow or into several buckets.
Mm-hmm.
And then I lay out my bulbs in there. And usually we're spacing bulbs. The mantra is pointy end up. Keep repeating that, pointy end up. And set our bulbs in there, spaced out, usually 3 to 3, 4, 5 inches apart or so. And again, in one hole, in that one trench, you can mix several varieties of daffodils or different varieties of tulips, different colors, or again, this early, mid, and late season bloom time spacing. So then you get this really beautiful burst of color in that area. Mm-hmm. And I'll go along then, I don't dump the same soil back in that hole. I'll dig another trench, right, continuing across the garden bed, and that soil will fill the first trench.
Mm.
And then work my way across. And finally, when I get down to the far end, and hopefully I'll have done planted 200 or 300 or 400 bulbs, then I'll bring those buckets or wheelbarrow of soil down to that end and dump it in where I started at the beginning.
Okay. Is this to partly just kind of rotate soil around and move nutrients around?
No, not at all. It's more a matter of just making it, you know, a more efficient planting. I mean, I do not plant one bulb at a time. They have these individual bulb planters. You can punch a hole into the ground 6 inches, 8 inches deep, sprinkle a little fertilizer in the bottom, a little bit of soil, drop one bulb in, and then cover it up.
Uh-huh.
And I'm doing this wholesale where I'm planting for some, I've got a couple of customers where I plant 1,000 bulbs or more over the course of 2 days. And one at a time doesn't make it.
No. Okay. Well, that
so
makes
you
sense.
Can do a lot. And again, that also means that you have a lot more color. Yes, it costs some more money to buy that many bulbs. But again, think about what, you know, what do you want to see? Do you want to see, you know, a big, beautiful display of multiple colors versus, you know, buy one or two packages which will have 5 or 10 bulbs in them? That doesn't quite give enough color appeal, whether you're planting for you or you're planting for the neighbors or the people driving by. Think about that. You know, it's kind of like with seeds. Bulbs are really not all that expensive.
Right.
And the amount of pleasure you can get. Think about cutting flowers. If you want to cut some of these as they're just starting to open, to bring them inside, again, that's a nice, cheerful thing.
Yeah.
Even if you're planning ahead for cutting flowers for friends, that's certainly always appreciated too.
Yeah, that makes sense. That's so when you're planning all that, you want to be thinking about that bulb selection and the variety and going for it. Don't be shy about the bulbs.
The other thing, something else that can be done, again, in this same trench I was talking about, so I've got my big bulbs down in the bottom, the daffodils, say, and usually, well, it's getting earlier and earlier with them, too. I had daffodils blooming March this year, which is certainly earlier than usual. But as we can fill this trench in halfway over the top of these big bulbs, then we can sprinkle a little more fertilizer in this half depth trench now, and we can plant some smaller bulbs. Some of the things that are earlier to bloom, snowdrops, crocus, blue scilla, kyanodoxa, that will come up, they will bloom, and they may be 2 to 3 weeks earlier than the blooming of the daffodils, and then which are earlier than the tulips. Then you fill in over the top of them with the whatever leftover soil you have. The advantage, again, is that we've got a longer period of flowering and color. So these small bulbs are usually earlier to flower, and then the bigger stuff comes along, and the foliage of the big later blooming plants, bulbs, hide the foliage of the small stuff that's already finished blooming.
Mm-hmm.
Because we really, ideally, for those bulbs to come back next year and year after that, we want to leave that foliage there as long as possible to make some more food to store in the bulb, going back into the bulb for the following year.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense. Huh. Well, you know, that feeding our beds and feeding our next plants kind of is an interesting segue to a question that was emailed in for you. And it's kind of about...
Okay.
It's a little bit of a shift from bulbs, but it's related to what you were just talking about. So this question was emailed in, and I'd like to put it out there to listeners that if you want to take this opportunity to call in and ask Ed a question, we've got him on the phone, and we have a little bit of time today, so this is a good chance to call in with a question. But until then, here's an emailed question. I'm in need of adding nutrients to a new raised bed I have, and we have access to fish. Do you recommend that I place fish pieces in the bed to overwinter in the hopes that it will have robust soil come spring? What do you think about that, Ed?
certainly, if you can get away with it, and this is going to be decided by the number of bears, dogs, and other critters in your neighborhood, mm-hmm. if you can get away with that. I mean, the deer are not going to mess with that stuff.
Right.
So certainly I have done in the past, you know, whether it be humpies or scrap, you know, fish trimmings, skeletons, carcasses, whatever, I have done in the past. Juneau's got a lot of bears. I've been very fortunate this year. I mean, the bears haven't even bothered any of my apples. I have seen no trace of bears in my yard, no piles of their droppings on my driveway. Been very fortunate.
Wow. Good.
If I can get away with it, yes. Certainly bury it deep, you know, dig it, again, kind of like with digging the trenches for the tulips we mentioned. Mm-hmm. If you've got some buckets of scraps, or, you know, whole humpies or whatever it is, maybe the hatchery has stuff left over, or the fish processing plant. Mm-hmm. Bury them down in there, and even throw some extra seaweed on top of the carcasses mm-hmm. before you cover that over in the beds. And then I would recommend covering your garden bed or box with a tarp or with some plastic also. All of this is to try to minimize other critters digging them up. Again, whether that be, certainly I've had problems with the ravens doing it, and I don't know if they're watching me hunting these salmon or whatever it is I'm doing out there. But again, that can help for the bears and dogs too, to try to keep them out of that place from digging it up over the winter, mm-hmm. or in the fall at least. And again, by springtime, it's worth thinking about what the gardener wants to plant in those beds next year also.
Mm-hmm.
So generally, you would prefer more of the leafy crops. Say it's a bed that you'll have cabbages, broccoli, cauliflower, kale in there, or lettuce, Swiss chard, that kind of stuff. I'm using lots of compost, occasionally some fish buried deep in the beds where I'm planting garlic, because they're heavy feeders too.
Mm.
Or if you're trying to stimulate your rhubarb, same thing. You can, and you can get away with something, again, that will kind of reduce the smell mm-hmm. of the attractiveness of those fish parts, is actually you could freeze them first.
Oh.
Freeze them in a flat pan or just on a cookie sheet, as far as that goes.
Hmm.
Freeze them and bury them frozen. So then they don't give off so much as fresh scraps would be likely to do.
Interesting. And
certainly it's a terrific nitrogen source.
Okay.
And again, if you've got bones in there too, you get extra phosphorus also.
Mm-hmm.
Use it if you can get away with it. You know, you just have to think about what's your neighborhood like,
mm-hmm.
and are you right next to the forest, or, you know, if you've got a fenced yard, well, that's a plus, then hopefully it'll also keep out the neighborhood dogs, too,
mm-hmm.
from getting in there and digging around.
Okay, that makes sense. So generally, yes, it will benefit the soil. Yes, it will add a lot of nutrients of the kinds that your plants want.
I mean, yeah, soil microorganisms, it'll help break things down in there. And, your plants will definitely benefit mm-hmm. by them. It's almost like you can see when the roots of the plants get down to that rotted fish carcasses, and away they go.
Right.
So, yeah, it's good stuff to use. And, again, use some seaweed, too. And, again, the seaweed can kind of help in the scent camouflage, mm-hmm. as it were, in those beds. So spread it out, too. Don't do a real concentrated one big pile right in the center of the bed, but if you can spread it out in a trench or two down the length of the bed, mm-hmm. would be better also.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Is there any sense in, like, having a compost area in which you're putting fish that you can kind of have more control over, like fencing off from dogs or anything, rather than directly into the beds?
I don't know about the composting part. My experience is generally, you know, where with compost you kind of want to turn the bed every now and then, or turn the pile,
yeah,
or the bin or whatever you've got. I would just soon not have to. I don't want to disturb this buried fish. Let's put it that way.
Right, right, right.
You know, once it's down there, I want to leave it there. By, you know, if you put it in this fall, by next fall, it's all going to be, all that's going to be left there are some of the bones.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not too bad. But you don't want to disturb it in the springtime. It's pretty bad.
Mm-hmm.
And definitely that, if you disturb that and turn it over, the smell is even more powerful than it would be with fresh stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So less disturbance is better. So that's why I'm saying bury it deep. If you can get it down there a foot deep or in the bottom of a, you know, say if you've got 2x12s as your box, you know, 12-inch deep garden box or bed,
yeah,
bury it down there deep, and the roots will grow down into it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And so even though you're not going to want to disturb it in the spring, you can definitely still plant into that in the spring.
Oh, yeah, planting over the top of it, certainly.
Yeah. Great. Cool. Well, that's good to know, and I'm sure our the emailer of that question is listening and is grateful for that information. Well,
again, that, you know, that's one more thing. The other thing, like I said, seaweed is starting to become available on the beaches. So mm-hmm. certainly, gathering the seaweed now or whenever, you know, folks are out in their boats, have some empty buckets or garbage bags to haul the stuff home in, pile it in and around the raspberry beds, around some of your perennials. We may talk more about that as we're putting our gardens to bed a little later on at September, October,
mm-hmm.
but that's all beneficial. And again, just we are bringing nutrients back to the land mm-hmm. that have washed off the land with all the amount of rainfall that we did, of course.
Right.
Just like the salmon swim upstream, that's one way of redistributing the nutrients, bring them back to the forest.
Right.
Again, if we can bring that seaweed and those salmon back to the land, again, that can feed a whole new crop that will then feed us.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, with seaweed, I'd heard a year or two ago a friend recommended making a compost tea from seaweed. Have you ever tried that, or do you know much about that?
I do, yeah. In fact, a lot of times what I do, maybe you haven't been in on this discussion, but making weed juice, literally pulling the weeds from our garden, and it can even be some of your scrap plants too that are done producing, whether they're bolting lettuce or broccoli and that kind of stuff. Tossing the weeds and such in a bucket, preferably without seeds. You don't want plants that have gone to seed throwing into your bucket. Filling it with water. Toss in a few handfuls of seaweed with that and let it ferment. It'll turn into this dark brown slimy goo in a couple of weeks. And then you take that material, that liquid, well, it's marginally liquid at times. it's kind of like slime, brown slime. But then dilute that. Okay. That's where you do want to be careful. You don't want to, don't pour it on full strength. I usually dilute it 4 or 5 to 1, you know, like a gallon of this brown thick liquid to 4 gallons of water. And then use that then to water plants in your greenhouse or transplants that you're putting out into the yard.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely beneficial.
Wow, okay. And so if people are making that from seaweed, is that something they start in the fall and it does its slime juice making over the winter? Or
well,
how long
pretty
is that
much time? Any time of year you need it. The challenge, of course, you know, usually in the fall there's a lot more seaweed available on the beaches.
Right.
Compared to the summertime. Although in the summer, if you're out in a boat and can collect some kelp,
yeah,
that would be really when we're making this stuff too. That's where normally, if I'm just putting seaweed on my garden in the fall, around my raspberries, apple trees, perennials and stuff, I don't worry about the salt. I don't wash it. I don't rinse it off.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're making this stuff particularly for use in greenhouse situations, you're going to be fermenting it, that would be a place where you would rinse, you know, if you fill a bucket of seaweed, fill it up with water once, dump the water out, that's usually enough to rinse off the residual salt.
Uh-huh.
Where if it's out in an open garden situation, Mother Nature and the rain that she brings us is usually enough to rinse the salt off,
mm-hmm.
and it leaches through the soil. We just don't want, particularly in greenhouse again, can have salt build up, and that salt can definitely poison plants. I mean, it can get mm-hmm. too salty to the point where plants do not thrive or worse.
Okay, interesting. That's a good consideration if you're going to be working with seaweed, especially if you're making that concentrate. rinse it.
Yes.
Yep.
Yeah, and the same thing kind of goes. You can buy dried seaweed or seaweed powder, and now that stuff has previously been rinsed when whoever made this stuff. I've got some at home, and that stuff you can use, especially if it's the powdered material. You can actually use it as and mix it up as a liquid, like using warm water. Mix it as a liquid, and you can water again. You can water it in around plants, or even to spraying the liquid on plant leaves. It is also said to be somewhat frost protective, using the seaweed, the liquid seaweed. Or you can buy liquid, literally liquid seaweed, which is this concentrated brown, slimy stuff that does need to be diluted. And usually, again, the container that you get will normally give you directions how much to dilute it, or how many, you know, whether it be a quarter cup to a gallon of water, or whatever the dilution rate is.
Okay, and so if a person wants to make that, if they're making that kelp or seaweed tea, what's the ratio of sort of water to weeds or seaweed that you want to get started with?
Yeah, well, at least if I'm using green weeds from my garden, there I will, again, I just fill up a bucket and then add the water to it. And then, like I said, from there I'll dilute it about 5 to 1.
Okay.
So with the seaweed, you can do pretty much the same kind of thing. Fill your bucket with seaweed, leave it out in the open, and, you know, I suspect this weekend, we're supposed to get all that rain, that your bucket may be full by the end of the weekend with water.
There you go.
And then, again, dilute it 5 to 1 or a bit more.
Mm-hmm. And you said it takes a couple of weeks to sort of decompose
in
that water.
It happens. The stuff breaks down. And again, if you want to stir it, you know, give it a little stir every couple of days, that'll help it break down more.
Mm-hmm.
Different kinds of seaweed break down more quickly. So, say, if you're using our usual popweed, the fucus from the beaches, that breaks down reasonably quickly. Or if you go get the really fine, thin stuff, does too. But comparing that to, say, bull kelp, the fronds, the leafy parts, again, break down fairly quickly. But the thick, round, those big stems are much slower to break down.
Right.
So, again, it just depends on which you know, different kinds of seaweed are different, I guess. There may well be different nutrients. You might have to do some research on that one.
Mm-hmm.
But that, it makes a difference. And again, if you're using weeds from the garden, some kind of big, thick, woody stems are going to be a lot slower to break down, like from a cabbage or a broccoli plant, compared to chickweed or buttercup leaves. Those are going to break down fairly well. So that's kind of the one useful place at buttercups might come in, that you can use those in making this wheat juice.
Yeah.
So they feed, you know, they've been stealing nutrients from your plants. Well, you can get the nutrients back that way.
Right. And so the main point with making sure they haven't gone to seed is that you don't want to be pouring seeds back in, you like planting those seeds.
Exactly, right. Yeah. And the other nice thing is, even if you've got roots of these plants, the fermentation process in the buckets is usually going to kill the roots.
Hmm.
Now, with buttercups, sometimes you may see they can actually grow in very wet conditions. So you might see the buttercups trying to grow up out of your bucket of water. So that means that's going to be one of those places where you're going to need to stir them, and you might even have to weight them down with a rock so they do not get the oxygen that they want and try to keep growing. But again, you give them a few weeks, and usually they it all turns into brown slime.
So if you're using this brown slime as a nutrient amendment throughout the growing season, is there like too much that you can put in, or how often do you want to add this to your soil?
Well, as you're, I suppose part of what might make a difference if you're doing outdoor gardens versus in the greenhouse gardens.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, they say and this applies to using something like Miracle-Gro or other liquid plant foods, that you use it weekly. So, like every week, if you're watering your plants with some of this stuff, you're going to be diluting this material.
Mm-hmm.
So that is a weak solution the plants can use it, but you're not building up too much nutrients in the soil. You don't really want to do that. You don't want to over-fertilize.
Right.
Because then again, it's, well, if it's in the open, Mother Nature and the rain will wash it away, but in the, it can build up in the greenhouse situation. So that's, again, that's where you want to be more careful about not over-fertilizing.
What does it look like on the plants when they're kind of being overly fed? Does it kill the plants?
Well, with depending on the nutrients, if it's just high nitrogen, you may have this really lush green growth. You'll see that really easily if you over-fertilize strawberry plants.
Mm-hmm.
You get great big leaves and no flowers.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Same thing applies to something like nasturtiums.
Mm-hmm.
You can get huge nasturtium leaves. I mean, 6-8 inch across nasturtium leaves.
Wow.
And no flowers.
Oh, how sad.
If you've got too much nitrogen.
Yeah.
So, but otherwise, if you have too high a potassium or phosphorus, you may actually get almost looks like tip burn, or the edge of the leaves may turn yellow and brown.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you're giving them too much, and something similar with salt too. So again, it tends to turn things more yellowish than to brown. I mean, leaves may die.
Right.
If you're over-fertilizing. So again, that's where the weekly part comes in. Better to do it a little bit every week.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're kind of giving them a steady dose of fertilizer and nutrients to keep them growing on a steady pace,
mm-hmm.
rather than this huge burst of growth.
Right. Cool. Okay. Well, that's...
And it applies if you're fertilizing a lawn. You know, you can sure. over-fertilize a lawn, and you can see, particularly it's easy when you're using something like a drop spreader where it all just drops onto the lawn. You can see yellow, if you miss strips, you don't get even coverage, you may get a very interesting pattern. You may have yellow stripes on your lawn where you didn't get full coverage.
Uh-huh.
You can even do checkerboard patterns if you get really creative.
Yeah, I suppose so. Oh. Well, this has been really useful information, I'm sure, and thank you to the questioner who had put us on that track. Yeah, definitely, this is a good time of year to be thinking about soil preparation and the whole thing. And our listeners will have a little extra time to think up questions and to do some of this good work, because we're taking next week off, because you're going to be on the road taking a trip.
And, hopefully doing some harvesting up north to fill the freezer, and then we'll come back and probably be talking more about harvesting, because we are doing a lot of it, and we'll be doing more. So harvesting, it's harvest season.
It is. Okay. Well, that sounds good. Good luck up there, and may you have all the success that you want. Getting what are you hoping to bring home? A moose, caribou?
Well, we have a bison reserved at a ranch in Delta Junction. So we know we've got, well, half a bison. We're going to split it with some friends.
Mm-hmm.
We do have tags for moose and caribou. We don't really need to shoot one of each. But there's also grouse and rabbits available. So we'll see what comes along.
Sounds fun. All right, Ed. Well, thank you for all this wonderful information, and we will talk to you after next week. Yeah.
All right. Two weeks from now.
Okay.
We'll see you then.
Sounds good. It's been a pleasure.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Bye, Aaron.
Well, thank you for listening to In the Garden with Ed Bajarski and myself, Oren Pearson. Flower Farm is a big contributor for this program. They feature season-end opportunities on all outdoor plants, perennials, trees, and shrubs, which you can plant this fall for a gorgeous summer next year. They're open 10 to 5 every day except Wednesdays at 6 Rory Road, Papke Landing, Papke's. Okay, stay tuned for Laura Lee Mason with her always wonderful High Country show coming up next.
But it's nothing a homegrown tomato won't cure. Put them in a salad, put them in a stew. make your very own tomato juice. You can eat them with eggs, you can eat them with gravy. Eat them with beans, pinto or navy. Put them on the side, put them in the middle. Put a homegrown tomato on a hot cake griddle.
Homegrown tomatoes, homegrown tomatoes. What will life be without homegrown tomatoes? Only two things that money can't buy, and that's true love and homegrown tomatoes.
Tomato seed, 'cause I know what this country needs. It's homegrown tomatoes in every yard you see. When I die, don't bury me in a box in a cemetery. Out in the garden, be much better, and I could be pushing homegrown tomatoes.
Homegrown tomatoes, homegrown tomatoes, homegrown tomatoes. What'll life be without homegrown tomatoes? Only two things that money can't.